Grant versus State of Washington Department of Revenue. Please come forward. Morning. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Paul Neal, and I'm here representing Northwest Territorial Mint. This case presents, I think, the next logical iteration of the issue that this court dealt with in the Sprint Spectrum v. DOR case. Like that Sprint Spectrum case, you have an appeal from the Board of Tax Appeals. You've got timely service on the parties. You've got timely filing of the petition for judicial review. Unlike Sprint Spectrum, here you've got substantial compliance with the requirement to serve the Board of Tax Appeals. The trial court judge decided that it had to be strict compliance and therefore granted the motion to dismiss. DOR in their briefing submits that it's either strict compliance or non-compliance. I would submit that that's not consistent with the decisions of both this court and the Supreme Court that talk about substantial compliance.
Let me ask you a question about substantial compliance. As I understand it, within the time within which the board had to be served, no effort was taken to deliver the notice of appeal to the board in any fashion. Is that accurate?
That's true. It wasn't until 17 days later.
How can you have substantial compliance if within the time period an act is required, you do nothing to accomplish the act?
Well, substantial compliance is defined as doing what's required by the statute, albeit in a procedurally deficient fashion. What's required by the statute is that the board be served. That was done.
Okay, well, it's actually a little more than that. It's serve the board within a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. You've carved out one of the requirements to make it, but normally you have to try and do something within the time lot allotted to you to do it to have substantial compliance. And you seem to be skipping that piece of the definition.
Well, I think if you look to the purpose of the statute, which was discussed by this court both in Sprint Spectrum and in the Banner case, the purpose of the statute is to give the board the ability to forward the record on appeal.
Right. And if you had the board not act as quickly as it had here and that record didn't get there on time, would you then lose?
I don't believe so. I think you would get to the question of at what point. Like if you look at the Banner case and the Sprint Spectrum case, the Banner case there was service, but it was not until after the case was dismissed. So clearly that was too late. In Sprint Spectrum there was never service. At what point would their service be so late as to no longer be substantial compliance? I'm not sure where that line would be, but I think the facts of this case show that the administrative record was submitted well before the Superior Court's deadline. There was no prejudice.
Why isn't the time deadline set by the statute analogous to a statute of limitations?
I think because it doesn't go to any of the three elements of jurisdiction that the courts have identified. There's subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay, well, we're not talking about jurisdiction here. We're talking about whether or not the remedy the legislature has provided is available to your client when he doesn't follow the rules the legislature set.
Well, I would submit that it goes to there's the third issue of jurisdiction that a filing deadline goes to, which is whether the court has authority over the particular case in front of it as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction. And my reading of the case is that goes to, was this case filed on time? And that is jurisdictional. And even though the ruling case tells us that in some...
Judge Becker's concurrence, the jurisdiction gets used very sloppily in some of the older cases. I don't think the constitutional power of the court to act here is implicated by when your client served the board.
No, I would agree. There's no issue of subject matter
jurisdiction. The question is whether or not your client's entitled to a remedy under the statute when your client doesn't follow the rules set forth in the statute.
And I think that the case here is, I think the answer to that question is you look at, is there a requirement of strict compliance or substantial compliance? I believe the correct standard is substantial compliance for very valid policy reasons set out in a number of cases that I've cited in my brief. I think that the facts here show substantial compliance because the court in both Sprint Spectrum and Banner went to some fair amount of trouble to talk about what is the purpose of the statute. And so if you look at, was that met here? I think it was met. I don't believe strict compliance is the right standard. If it were, I think it would be very confusing as to why this court in Sprint Spectrum spent time talking about substantial compliance if that wasn't an available remedy here. I think that the discussion in that opinion indicate.
Well, it may be this court teeing off on the use of the term under a different facts scenario by the Supreme Court, where, in fact, substantial compliance was the question, and that was has to do with the method of whether it was sufficient. Here, it would seem to me the proper inquiry would probably be akin to Rule 2.4 of the Rules of Federal Procedure, and that is whether or not there's good cause to waive the requirement of compliance with time limits, i.e., filing of the notice of appeal, substantial compliance, a rule we've applied in RAP proceedings, rules on appeal, not the RAPs, but rather appeals from courts of limited jurisdiction. Too many letters in there for me. At any rate, now that, however, is judicial. This is statutory. And it seems to me if you blow it, you blow it. And if you blow it, you're left with a constitutional writ. And if you haven't got a constitutional mountain on which to climb, you're done.
Well,
it has nothing to do with jurisdiction. It has to do with compliance with the statute. That's a prerequisite to proceeding.
And I would agree with that. And so I think the question of did I blow it or not is a question of did I substantially comply with the requirements of the
statute.
That
was in the third person. I didn't mean to say you.
Well, I understand. But I know. But I also
understand.
What about
the statement from the Seattle versus Pert case where the Supreme Court says it's impossible to substantially comply with a statutory time limit? It is either complied with it or it isn't. And, I mean, I remember a case that Judge Kennedy wrote out of San Juan County where the clerk's office closed at 4:30 and they pushed it under the door at 4:35 and they tried to argue substantial compliance. Mm-hmm. And no way, you know, it just doesn't work with time limits.
Again, I think that goes to this question of was it properly before the court, which is the third prong of jurisdiction. A filing requirement to file with the court is necessary to bring it in front of the court. And I think
what's the case that says that's a third prong of, quote, jurisdiction?
I don't have the side of my fingertips, but it's in my
because
brief.
Because normally, I mean, prongs of jurisdiction. I mean, there's subject matter jurisdiction and there's personal jurisdiction. We don't have another prong.
Well, according to the case law, there are three requirements for jurisdiction.
According to the case law, jurisdiction means a million things. Okay, mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to look for a solid, mm-hmm. you know, constitutionally grounded theory that says there's three prongs. And,
okay.
and you can tell me what the other prong is, but I don't think of jurisdiction as prongs. It goes to the power of the court to decide a particular case
and
exercise power over a particular individual.
Perhaps you can find that while we're hearing opposing counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Callie-Ann Castillo. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Department of Revenue. As this Court has recognized in its questioning, this case is not about substantial compliance. Simply because Northwest Territorial eventually served the Board of Tax Appeals does not mean that it met the standards set by the legislature under 3405 under the APA. And in that case, the legislature set forth the specific requirements to obtain judicial review of an agency's order. It sets who must be served, it sets when they must be served, and it sets how they must be served. And in this particular case, Northwest Territorial did not meet the timeliness of serving the Board of Tax Appeals, the agency who actually issued the order in this case. And therefore, it cannot obtain judicial review of that agency's decision because it did not meet the standards of the Administrative Procedure Act. Substantial compliance requires actual compliance, though procedural faulty. And in this particular case, there was no procedural fault with the Northwest Territorial Mint's service on the board. They were 17 days late beyond the APA's deadline, and therefore they did not comply. There wasn't a matter of that they attempted to comply. They, in fact, did not. And therefore, under the case law that has been set by the Washington Supreme Court and this court, there is no case that allows noncompliance with the timing requirement to meet the APA standards.
Are there any cases, or would you say that there are any circumstances under which there could be substantial compliance? And I'm thinking of an example where, for instance, somebody really made a good faith effort to file something on time, but due to flood or train wreck or other act of that they had no control over, it simply didn't get there. But it would have if it hadn't been for this force majeure.
That might be an example of substantial compliance if they had in fact attempted to serve the board prior to that 30-day deadline. But the fact of the matter is that our particular statute is very clear when it comes to serving the agency. And in fact, it delineates between what type of service is required on the agency. In this particular case, the statute says that delivery must be upon the principal office by that deadline. Unlike service on the parties, it does not require mailing. It requires delivery on that 30-day deadline. And if it is not met during that time, then it would not be compliance.
I suppose, I mean, another example might be, and I think Judge Gross has written a case in this vein, is like you're supposed to serve it on somebody, but the somebody you're supposed to serve it on is never there. You know, so it's catch-22. You can't. And in that case, I think you might have an argument for substantial compliance.
Correct.
And you serve it on somebody else who is there, because you keep trying to serve it on the person who's supposed
well,
to be there.
That's the facts of the Medina case.
The Medina case,
I recall.
But yet.
That's substantial compliance with the process. You can't substantially comply with a deadline. You either did or you didn't. Now, if the passes are closed and this matter has to be filed in having just traversed a pass and almost quit this morning, which frequently happens given the shortage of budget to the State Department of Transportation to plow, so I can't come. Now, a hard case would say, too bad. I should have tried 2 or 3 days earlier, if not weeks earlier. After all, the time limit isn't that short. But nevertheless, isn't, and I made this point earlier, isn't that really excusable noncompliance, if I can make a case for that?
But there's no case that allows...
That's what we're here for.
Correct.
Thank you. There's no case. I know that.
And therefore, what I'm saying is that this court shouldn't deviate from that in this from the Supreme Court's ruling of
which ruling
of Medina, which said in the City of Seattle versus Perk that failure to comply with a statutorily set time limitation cannot be, ever be considered substantial compliance.
I'm not ever going to argue that it's substantial compliance. That's what I'm telling you. Give me a good policy reason, if you will, why we shouldn't have the application of Rule 2.4B or whatever we're calling it this week, which is that. With respect to appeals, what we're interested in is substantial justice, not substantial compliance. And so unless there's some, if you will, compelling policy reason as to why parties are prejudiced, why would we dismiss an appeal and hence not decide the substantive underlying matter?
Because it's a role for the legislature. And in this particular case, under the APA, the legislature has specifically said when it wouldn't be okay, and when they said that if you don't serve the Attorney General's office, that's sufficient to not dismiss the case. But they did not say the same thing for the agency who issued the decision. And it's the legislature's decision who made that call of when it's okay to not have the remedy of dismissal. And in this particular case, they did not serve the Board of Tax Appeals, and therefore the legislature and the law of this state is that dismissal is required. There
along,
is no
in the vein
similar.
Of what Judge Gross is talking about, you know, for, I mean, we have in the court system a pretty solid rule about filing a notice of appeal within 30 days. But a notice of appeal, I mean, that time limit by the rules can't be waived, and the same is true of a motion for reconsideration. You've got to do it within 10 days or else, except for, quote, extraordinary circumstances, which case law has nailed down as being truly extraordinary. I think the case I'm thinking of involved an attorney whose office was destroyed by flood or fire or something like that, and or people are get really, really sick. You know, I realize that the you're saying, well, our statute doesn't have a provision for extraordinary circumstances, but I'm just wondering whether a court wouldn't read that in. Probably not in this case, but in some other case.
Possibly, Your Honor, but in this particular case, especially for as clear as the legislature is, when it says that dismissal is not required, then the court would not want to add in additional requirements that the legislature has not already set.
Does the record provide any explanation as to why the board wasn't served until 17 days late?
No, the record is clear that there is no question of why or why he didn't serve.
So there's no showing of extraordinary circumstances here that prevented service?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, it was my doing that notified the party that they were in fact late on this. And so it's questionable if...
So you should have just kept quiet, apparently. Huh?
That's another question, Your Honor, but of whether, you know, what is late. And under my opposing counsel's theory, what would be substantial compliance? Would it be 2 days late? Would it be 33 days late? What, you know, there's no...
That is the difficulty.
That is the difficult question. And therefore, the legislature has made clear, and the courts have made clear, you either comply with the time limit or you don't. And in this particular case, they did not comply with the statute as required and therefore cannot obtain judicial review of their decision. If there are no other further questions for this
court. Well, actually, there's case law that they can if, in fact, he'd been delayed. Say the statute's 7 days and it was 8 days and he couldn't get through the pass. That's a constitutional writ, and you're going to have to do it that way. So I'm not sure that any of this gets anybody anywhere except on clear facts, and this may be the case for clear facts. What I'm saying is to be careful how far you take your arguments.
Thank you. Is there any further questions from the court?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, for the record, my name is Paul Neal with the Northwest Territorial Mint. I did want to point out that the case I was searching for is State v. Barnes. It's on page 8 of my opening brief. And just to quote it very quickly, there's a gist of the sentence. It says, generally, a valid judgment consists of three jurisdictional elements: jurisdiction of subject matter, jurisdiction of person, and power or authority to render a particular judgment. So as I read that, I think the power or authority to render a particular judgment goes to these filing deadlines, because unless it's filed with the court.
Well, as you read that, but, you know, I mean, that's one case. You know, if you're going to really make an argument based on jurisdiction, it seems to me you should have more than one case, because, of course, jurisdiction is a question all the time. I mean, you know, that's exactly the problem with the term jurisdiction, is that a case throws it out like that. And then somebody says, well, as I read that, that means that there's actually something else to jurisdiction and than has ever been recognized before. And so I'm going to take that and run with it. And then, you know, if that creeps into the case law, then we end up with real analytical problems. So, I mean, you'd have to show me why that means something that is of use to you here.
Do you know in Barnes whether they were making a distinction between courts of general jurisdiction, like the trial courts in the state of Washington, and courts that have only those authorities given to them, like the federal trial courts?
I don't know in that case, or I do know that in the Saltis case, they talked about that a little bit, these different substantial compliance standards. I'm mixing substantial compliance and jurisdiction, which is part of what I wanted to get back to Judge Becker, is that I'm actually trying to make the opposite argument. This is not jurisdictional.
All right.
I guess I'm not being very. I agree with you that this is not a jurisdictional issue. That's the point. That's why I think substantial compliance.
Why does Barnes help you?
Because she's very sensitive about it doesn't mean you shouldn't argue it. Because it seems to me, in the case of the legislatively created right, that there being no necessary right to access the courts with regard to the administrative aspect of a tax appeal, if you will, constitutionally, yes. And then we'll get in that. Then I think perhaps you get into these rather esoteric, if not epistemological, arguments about what jurisdiction means. But in this circumstance, you don't have a right to be in the trial court.
Unless you meet the
procedural
requirements.
Unless you have a constitutional writ, and that's going to be extraordinarily difficult. And you're going to have to argue that the state of Washington had no constitutional authority to tax you, or that the board had no constitutional authority to tax you in this manner under the statute in which they acted.
But how does Barnes help you? I don't understand what you're trying to do with Barnes.
Well, all I was trying to do was show that this was not a jurisdictional issue.
That it's not.
That had this been a late filing, then I think it would be arguably a jurisdictional issue. But this is not a jurisdictional issue.
Okay.
So that's my whole point with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, but I think the discussion in Union Bay is useful for substantial compliance. I'm out of time. I just would ask the court to look at that, because they do contemplate applying substantial compliance to an APA. In that case, it was a service on a party. They concluded they couldn't in that case, but they indicated that it was available.
Thank you, Tom.